think we often, consent to the recording. I don't think we often think of archival research methods as particularly well situated for giving voice to individuals and giving sort of highlighting their experiences and identities. We might think of it as a little bit less likely to give individual level or micro level data. And so I wanted to sort of highlight how we brought that to the fore in this paper through our archival research methods. So I will dive right in. I already had the generous introduction, so I won't go into too much detail on my background, but my PhD is also in sociology. So I wanted to highlight that it's a joint degree program. And so I think some of my methodological training, although it's not historical research methods or history training, I think the sociological training probably has ended up playing a larger role in the type of work that I do as well. So I really consider myself an organizational sociologist, hanging out in a business school, as probably many of you in the audience here today, just from being interested in this research method. And I'm primarily driven by understanding, as Christian said, social movement-driven changes within society and organizations. So how social movements come to structure organizations differently. And I'm quite interested in longitudinal change processes. And I'm a fan of qualitative and quantitative text analysis. So I think archival research methods lend themselves very well to these methodological interests. Obviously, with the longitudinal processes, you can follow things over time. And with the text analysis interest, you really need a pretty large archive of text data to work with, especially if you're going to do any type of quantitative text analysis as well. So I actually, before I deep dive into the org science piece, I thought I would highlight how I've used other archival research methods in different papers just to show the sort of variety of archival research methods that I think are possible and are out there and that I personally have had good experience using. So I have this paper, first of all, with my former thesis advisor, Braden King. And we look at an online forum. So an online forum that was set up in the early 1990s to talk about sustainability in higher education. So basically, how can colleges and universities, primarily in the United States, green their operations? So things like green building policies, things like recycling, these types of practices over time. So I consider that forum or listserv to be an archival data source. So I was able to basically scrape all the messages or conversations from that forum over a 25-year period and analyze both quantitatively and qualitatively how the text changed over time using a procedure called topic modeling for the quantitative analysis and then an in-depth qualitative reading. So I'm not going to go into detail on this paper. It's just to show a different type of archival research method that I've used using digitized text in that case. And then I have a paper in org science that also came out of my dissertation, and it uses a really mixed methods approach. There's interviews in this paper, there's some observational data in this paper, but the archival data piece in this paper is looking at the evolution of standards over time that reflect changes in the occupational community of sustainability managers. So what I mean by that is that at the beginning, sustainability managers were this nascent occupational group, and they decided to come up with standards to govern their work. So what sort of should we be working on or not working on? How do we draw boundaries around our occupation? And I was able to retrieve all the various iterations of that standard over time, as well as comments from the occupational group on the standard as to why they chose to keep some things or add some things into their standard and why they chose to eliminate some of the proposed pieces of the standard. So for that one, I used something called the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive, which probably many of you are familiar with, but if you're not, it's a really, really cool tool that allows you to go back in time on websites. So you may go to an organization's website today, and a lot of the documents or a lot of the text on the website itself is only what you see in the live version, but you can put it into the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive, and you can go back as far back as that website has existed and see the changes over time, including things that were uploaded to the website and have since been taken down. So including files. It's not like any archive. It's not comprehensive. It's not perfect. But it's a really great tool for looking at change over time within a period like what I was looking at within the early 2000s, early 2010s, when actually a lot of the documents were shared through this organization's website, but have since been taken down. So I wanted to plug that if people are not familiar with that source as well. So what are some of the positives that we think about when we're considering whether or not to use archival methods? Things that I particularly like about archival data is that it's created in situ. So in the situation, in the time and place you're interested in studying. So it doesn't suffer from any type of retrospective bias. Although I guess on behalf of the researcher, there's a bit of retrospective bias, but not on behalf of your participants or who you are aiming to study. It's also quite backstage data, or it can be. So it's often data that's produced for the consumption of other field actors. Now, this is not necessarily true. You could look at press releases going back in time, and those are clearly front stage documents. But often if you get a good archival source, it's not produced necessarily for external audiences. So I think there's a little bit more authenticity to this type of data in that it's not someone recounting to you as a researcher their sort of idealized view of what unfolded or how it unfolded. It also really interestingly can give you a view of an entire field and different players in that field. So you're not just getting the story from one person's perspective or one organization's perspective, one actor's perspective. You're getting the view potentially, if you can find it in the archives, from multiple actors' perspectives. And I think that's really valuable as well if you're trying to do some sort of field level study to look at field level change. And I already talked about the longitudinal benefits of archival data. I think, you know, being able to trace something over time is really valuable for being able to understand how processes unfold over time and how things are interconnected over time. There are certainly challenges though with this type of methodology. One challenge that's been raised recently, I think a lot of us talk about this, but it's been raised recently by Stina Grodel, and I'll put a link here to this, talk about all this, is that sometimes in today's day and age, we might actually be overwhelmed with data when we're looking to use archival data and archival research methods. Now, this might seem like a good thing, because especially when you start your research journey, you certainly feel a scarcity of data, and that's worrying as well. But soon you start to get into both the documents that have been digitized as well as digital search tools. And it can feel very overwhelming very quickly in terms of the amount of data that's out there and where to actually start. So the reason I put the link to this podcast up is there's a researcher named Stina Grodel. I'm sure many of you are familiar with her work, and she is an excellent archival data researcher. And she recently did an interview-based podcast through this, initiative called the Ethnography Atelier, where she talks about using archival data. So I'm happy to share that link if the slides are going somewhere afterwards or in the chat when Sandeep is talking. And she talks about how to design a sampling system to try to deal with potentially the quantity of data that you might find if you go the route of the archival data research approach. She also talks about triangulation strategies and sifting through data more generally. So I really recommend that podcast. It's really fascinating. Another challenge is that archival data is not created for you. So it's not created for your research purposes, for your research question. It's very indirect. So it's not that you're going up to someone and saying, why did XYZ occur? What are the processes? You know, why did this happen? How did this happen? Tell me your story. You are having to piece together stories and perspectives and different motivations from really what's left behind in the archives, which can definitely be challenging. And you have to be, I think, a little bit careful about how much you're claiming because of this issue of the purpose for that data. You know, it was not for your particular research question, unfortunately. And I think this can also lead to criticisms that many of us have faced doing this type of work, that, you know, your work is too descriptive. And so we're all aiming to, you know, whether you're, you know, I'd say even especially if you're doing qualitative research or research here, you're aiming to have some kind of explanation for why or how things unfolded the way that they did. And the first cut of any kind of archival research project, I think, is purely descriptive. It's a historical timeline. It's a play-by-play of what happened over time. And then it's up to us as researchers to, like Sandeep's going to talk about, it sounds like, to think abductively about how that data then relates back to what we know about the theory in this space, and try to come up with and derive some theoretically interesting contribution. And so if you don't do that next step and you're just sort of reflecting the descriptive nature of your data, you're going to run into problems with reviewers. But it's not the end of the world. I think that often the first cut of a paper is that way, and it doesn't mean that it can't push through and have a theoretical contribution in subsequent revisions, if they'll give you a chance. So in the paper that I'm going to deep dive into, this is called Category Evolution Under Conditions of Stigma: The Segregation of Abortion Provision into Specialist Clinics in the United States. The questions we set out to answer with this paper, when we were sort of initially thinking about this is not just the formalized research question that's in the paper, but what were we curious about? And I should say this is with my co-author and really good friend, Alessandro Piazza, and he's excited that you guys have given us this opportunity to deep dive into the paper today. So we wanted to know, how did abortion come to be organized the way that it is in the United States? So if you're not familiar with the US context of abortion provision, I could give a 3-hour talk on that because it's obviously a minefield, but organizationally, excuse me, it's mainly offered in standalone clinics that are completely independent from hospital systems, which my co-author, who's European Italian, found very strange. And so it kind of took his outsider perspective through conversations for him to say, this is weird. You know, why is it this way? For me to realize that it didn't have to be that way, and for us to think, well, let's look into how it came to be organized that way. So who were the players who contributed to it being organized in this way? And importantly, what were their identities? What were their motivations? What were their goals or their hopes for organizing it this way? So basically, what were they trying to achieve with this? And then what processes ultimately were working towards or against organizing abortion in this standalone clinic format? These are the questions we're trying to answer. So we began by talking to contemporary activists and central players. We only conducted 5 formal interviews, but I think this was a really important step in our research process. In particular, I'll say this a couple times probably, but this is an almost an overstudied field, abortion provision in the United States. So you may be doing a research project that's in a very understudied field, and you might have different set of challenges, but our main initial challenge was where to focus, because we didn't know what time period was the most important. We didn't know which players were the most important. We were studying a really, you know, almost like a saturated topic, which it might be different if you're studying a topic that hasn't received as much attention. We also read a number of memoirs from early providers, books from historians, books from sociologists. So I have, you know, this memoir here from a guy whose father was ran an abortion clinic through some of the most tumultuous times in the 1980s. you can see my notes. and we read books by sociologists, all about, you know, abortion period right after Roe v. Wade. So we started there with secondary data sources. I guess the memoir is kind of a weird you know, it's kind of a primary data source. But anyway, a lot of people who had already looked at this, and that helped us also narrow the field a bit more. So we actually wrote the whole first draft of the paper based on these secondary sources, and we called it archival data research. And I'll spare you with what happened next. We had a reviewer who said, I have concerns with regards to the amount of the and scope of the data collected. The sources seem particularly scarce. Only a few interviews and some secondary data coming from already processed historical accounts, mainly books, problematic. You'd have to consider additional sources to build a more compelling data set. You might want to look for visual sources, old posters, adverts, etc. So we were lucky enough to get an R&R off of this scarce amount of data that we presented in the first version of the paper. But it was basically, I'd like to say we were enlightened in going into the archives, but it was really this reviewer who pushed us in this direction. So I have he or she to thank for that. So I'll show you the paper timeline because I was asked to give a little behind the scenes. So to be honest, this paper actually started at AMJ, and that original submission in 2018 is when we got that reviewer comment to do more primary archival data research. So we turned that around in we got the R&R in March of 2018. That's when we got the request for more archival data. So we conducted it that summer. And then we resubmitted in September. We had a second R&R in December. We resubmitted in 2019 in April, and we got rejected in July 2019. So that was a pretty hard-hitting rejection, as you can imagine. I think anytime you have a rejection after a second round R&R, it's very painful. And it took a lot to regroup, and we didn't know if the method would fly, in another journal, because let's be honest, we just don't see, you know, it's only been recently that we've seen a lot of, you know, high profile journals publishing historical methods. And we had kind of crafted the paper to the reviewers, which I think happens a lot of the time, and what they were asking for and what they wanted. So we were really unsure about it, whether or not it was going to fly somewhere else, but we got our confidence up and submitted to OrgScience pretty quickly, turned it around, had the first R&R in November of the same year, resubmitted that, and conditional accept in August 2020. So it was only one round at OrgScience, which is really great, but I think the paper wouldn't have been the paper it is today if it hadn't gone through actually the review process at AMJ first, and actually really excellent editor who is familiar with these research methods as well. And I still struggle with the rejection in the end, but it's a good story in the end. So the problem is, when we got this request from the reviewer, neither of us had ever stepped foot in an archive. So who are you going to call if you have no experience in archival research methods? A librarian. So librarians, this is probably quite obvious to all of you, but are excellent sources in this whole process, and they're really willing to help. And in this case, my sister's a librarian, so I called my sister and I said, I need to do some real research. Can you help me? And she said, okay, what are you trying to do? And I said, I want to go to archives. I want to find stuff about abortion clinics. I want to get back into the 1970s. I want to see who the owners were. I want to see who started these clinics. I want to understand what was going on. And she told me about this resource called Archive Grid. And Archive Grid is basically a compilation of different archival databases from across the U.S. Unfortunately, I looked into it for this talk. It's mainly the U.S. and some in Australia and Canada, but it doesn't cover outside of that region, those regions. So I'm sorry for mainly European audience that it might not be the most helpful tool. But if you are in the U.S. or you're looking to go to the U.S. to do research, I highly recommend it. So I'm actually going to pull up the website, but it's not a digitized repository of documents. It's a database of databases that helps you figure out which libraries might hold the contents that you're looking for based on basic search terms. So let me see if I can pull up How am I doing on time, guys? I think I only have a couple more minutes, right?
Grace, it is super fascinating.
Please good.
Okay. Take the time that you need.
Okay, I don't want to rush, but I also want to show you that, I don't want to take Sandeep's time. So in this archive grid interface, I can show you that all I've done is simply type the very basic search term of abortion. And the summary view here, there's two different views. There's a list view, which is the default view, which I actually don't find as helpful as the summary view if you're looking for the actual archive that you might want to go and visit. And what this tells me in the left-hand side bottom here is that Harvard's Schlesinger Library, which is one of the two archives that we visited, has the most documents related to the topic of abortion. But what's also helpful is some of these sort of keywords that have come up here with groups. For example, it tells me there's 113 documents related to the National Organization for Women. So if I didn't know which organizations maybe would be important in this case, let's say I'm just starting really from scratch here, I might not have come across, you know, the National Organization for Women. Then I could click there, and then that subsequently becomes my keyword search that will bring up different archives. And you can also get different topics. So you think, oh, actually, I actually really want to dig into the pro-life movement, for example. So we visited two archives. We visited Harvard's archive, and we visited the Wisconsin Historical Society archive. And actually, at the time, those were the two top archival sources here for the keyword abortion. And so it looks like USC has subsequently put a lot more linked a lot more resources to this, which is great. And basically, when you click through on a listing here, I'm giving you an example of one that we did visit, the Lawrence Lader papers, which were available at that Harvard Library. You get a lot of details from the library of what they hold, 18 cubic feet, and then a little bit of information about what is actually in those cartons. And then you can click through there, and Harvard Library also makes their archival database publicly visible here. So you can get even more information of what's held there. So basically all this is to say that when you're doing archival research in libraries, you want to put a lot of your work in upfront in actually identifying the places you want to visit, the contents that they hold, and then you have to put in specific requests to view certain contents before you arrive. So this may be just too basic for most people here, but me starting from scratch, I didn't know the process of how you actually go about it, and how you can't just show up at the library and say, I'd like to see things that you have about abortion. You're going to completely waste your time and their time, and it's going to be really time consuming, especially if you're planning a trip to visit the archives. All the work is really done up front. If it's in your backyard and you can go multiple times and you want to get a librarian there to help you, great. But if you actually have limited time to spend physically there, then I'd recommend going through databases. I saw someone put in the chat, the UK databases are easily accessible. That's great. The US, unsurprisingly, is a bit piecemeal, but I found this to be a really great resource. Should I ask if there's any questions before? I have a couple more slides, but are there any questions on Archive Grid or finding materials or contacting librarians? And I'm happy to answer those at the end as well. Till the end. Okay, I can always go back to this. So let me put my presentation back up. Okay, so this is still the same slide. Again, very few of the materials that we actually wanted to look at had been digitized, so it definitely for us required a physical visit to the archives rather than just looking at digitized materials. And this was the screenshot of the search results from the time that we did the project. So these were the top two places. And there are obviously other places we could have visited. And just, you know, resource-wise, we really could only afford to visit these two main places. And we found that they had such a wealth of information that honestly, we wouldn't have really needed to make trips to additional places. So at this time, we already had a broad outline of the historical narrative for the paper. We were clearly open to change of what we were going to find, but we really needed something to guide our search process. I think we would have been completely overwhelmed if we went in just very open and broad to what we were going to find. So we already knew the key players that we wanted to find out more about who had played a role in the organization of abortion into standalone clinics like Planned Parenthood and a social movement organization called NARAL. So we were able to look for archival materials that specifically related to their work at the time, their memos and their historical documents. And we knew we wanted to get some firsthand accounts from individuals who were actually running clinics. So we also made sure that both archives that we visited had archival materials from clinic founders and clinics in the area. And this is just an example of what I sent as a request before visiting one of the libraries to show the type of request I had to put in ahead of the visit to say, these are the materials I would like to have pulled from the archive so that when I show up, I can physically view all of these materials. So this is obviously a bunch of mumbo jumbo to you all, but it just shows again, the upfront work required in visiting. So what did we find? Well, I very clearly remember texting my co-author saying, I feel like I'm doing real research. So there's definitely something incredible about handling the materials from a certain era and being in an archive and just sorting through brochures, handwritten notes here from a woman who ran a clinic in Wisconsin from a speech that she was going to give at a Planned Parenthood event. Clippings that she had clipped out of local newspapers about her organization, I guess like mobilizing documents from different social movement groups during this era, lists of attacks on clinics and attacks that were happening. This is 1984 in the center here, talking about bombing attacks and arson attacks. So you also see what the organizations are paying attention to at the time based on what they are documenting. Entire reports about hospitals coming under attack. We didn't know at the time that hospitals had actually started out providing abortions in the US, and it was only after they had pressure from employees, stakeholders, and anti-abortion activists that they stopped the practice. And that actually became a key mechanism in the paper. It wasn't just the start of clinics that ended up shaping the organization of the field, it was also the fact that hospitals initially offered the service and then actually exited the market or the service. So this is all sort of materials and ephemera that we collected, not physically collected, but viewed and took photographs of during our time. So we spent two full days in the archives in the end. I think this is my second from last slide, so I'll wrap up in a second. Spent two full days each. I was in Wisconsin and my co-author was in Harvard. I'll say it was honestly one of the most efficient data collection experiences I've ever experienced, although it took so much time up front. When you're actually in the archives, it goes relatively quickly, I found. I took lots and lots of pictures. I didn't scan any documents. They usually have scanning machines available, but I just took pictures on my phone. We visited the archives at the same time so we could be in constant contact about what we were finding. And I think that was kind of an interesting approach. So we could say to my co-author, let's do a deep dive on this case. This looks really interesting. I took typed notes while I was going through the materials. We have about 37 single space pages of notes with my co-author. These are just example of notes, saying in box one, I found this woman who described herself as a feminist, young visionary. She was 26 years old when she started the clinic. And this person became one of really almost the protagonists in our org science paper. And then I also took notes like this entire box is not helpful, because if I were to go back to the archives, which I didn't, I would have been really helpful to know again, where to pick up and where to start. And all our images that we collected, we moved to in vivo for coding. So thankfully that in vivo accepts pictures, so as documents as well. We decided to deep dive on two cases to give voices to the clinic founders, and we found empirical support for three processes that helped explain why stigmatized categories remain largely populated by specialist organizations. So we came up with this theoretical contribution then. I'll put the three processes up there, but they're not that important to this talk. But basically, the reason we were able to elevate the paper from a descriptive paper to a theoretical paper was really based on, I think, the level of detail that we found in the archives. And that's it. Happy to answer questions.